Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for March 22nd. Up first is Andrew Evans writing on why Canada's electrical grid cannot handle the coming demands.
In 1905, Sir Adam Beck, who created the precursor to Ontario Hydro, spoke in the Ontario legislature about the very great influence upon the commercial development of the province that will be exercised by the furnishing of cheap power. In the time since, cheap power has been the backbone of the prosperity Canada achieved. Fed mostly from large hydroelectric dams, this cut rate, abundant supply of electricity enabled mass electrification and quality of life soared. Today we continue to reap the benefits and have a reliable, largely non-emitting grid that is the envy of the world. But the demands on our grids are in danger of outstripping our ability to supply them. Ontario is racing to build new nuclear plants safely in order to meet expected demand by 2029, while filling interim demand with new gas plants and a new call for renewables. Quebec is spending up to $185 billion to solidify provincial supply amidst rising demand both in and out of province, and British Columbia is filling a projected 15% increase in demand by 2030 with the first acquisition of new generation sources in 15 years. Even Manitoba, a province with abundant and previously boundless supplies of cheap hydroelectricity, is now projecting a deficit by 2029 and is being forced to restrict access to potential new businesses due to supply shortages. To solve the constraints on energy generation and to meet net zero 2050 targets, the federal government projects that grid demand will be twice that of today by 2050. To meet that rising demand, the output of the grid, which we have accumulated since we have had electricity, roughly the past 140 years, will have to double in the next 26 years. It's worth emphasizing this point. If Ottawa's projections are right, we'll need to essentially build out the equivalent of today's electricity supply in less than one-fifth of the time in the face of modern environmental regulations, indigenous consultations, and other bureaucratic processes that invariably slow down the construction of major infrastructure. Canada's electricity has been so abundant that we have grown used to reaping the benefits, including those seen by exporting major amounts of electricity to the United States. From these largely silent exports, we garner billions of dollars annually and saw record profits in 2022. Without sufficient surplus to export, these previously reliable financial windfalls will dry up and the provincial ratepayers will face higher costs, while governments who were using these funds to underwrite lower taxes or expanded services may have to reevaluate. Past yearly trends have shown reductions in total exports, despite continued profits. But the crunch is getting so bad that Quebec, long a source of seemingly limitless electricity, is facing shortages by 2027. U.S. states that have based their decarbonization on Quebec imports are increasingly fearful that agreements will fall through. The electricity grid is one of our most complex creations, providing power at any point along the gamut from vast industrial steel mills to the most minute individual demands. Large-scale changes can occur, although time is required to ensure that they do not destabilize the delicate balance. Ottawa's pursuit of more electrification of the Canadian economy is exacerbating the forecasts of supply shortfalls. Although many of the new technologies that will accompany this electrified life will make our lives easier and better, policymakers must recognize that a cheap, abundant supply of electricity must be available. Without it, there is no way we will achieve our objectives. For example, right now there are conflicting policy signals from Ottawa. It has both mandated that all new vehicle sales be electric by 2035, while also encouraging the expansion of heat pump uptake in homes. Both initiatives face headwinds from the clean electricity regulations, which seek to encourage decarbonization in provincial grids by 2035. Such rapid changes to the electricity grid bring extreme risk. Such risks are not good for reliable electricity supply, and costs from risks taken with the electricity system cannot be avoided if they go wrong. This sloppy policymaking endangers our future electricity supply-demand balance. Across the country, there is provincial buy-in, even in Alberta and Saskatchewan, for a 2050 net zero target for electricity grids. Ottawa should take this win, drop the confrontational approach it has now, and seek to build on this progress. The clean electricity regulations should be revoked because they contribute to this confrontation, are politically unnecessary, and do not recognize the unique provincial circumstances. An incoming Poilievre government can help to fix this shortage by working with the provinces to fund their existing plans. The federal government should take the position that provinces that want to build should be able to. This can be enabled by providing large-scale, cut-rate loans to build new electricity infrastructure for both generation and transmission capacity. These loans could also feature structuring arrangements wherein the more megawatts the project was to produce or transmit, the less the interest. Such incentives can allow Canadian policymakers to think bigger and unlock megawatts for booming populations and industries. Similarly, if the project was non-emitting, it could be eligible for lower interest rates. By enabling the construction of projects that have made it through the provincial policy gauntlet without overly constricting provincial choices, Ottawa can act constructively. Aligning with the anti-gatekeeper message, the federal government should activate the Canada Energy Regulator to break down silos in provincial grids by conducting work to pre-authorize new transmission corridors between provinces. The approval of transmission lines can easily take over a decade, while provincial silos in electricity grids promote unnecessarily expensive construction of new generation sources, causing higher consumer costs. Additionally, with much of our existing transmission capacity created for Canada-US trade, much of our import-export trade does not occur between provinces but instead between provinces and states. Though this is partly due to the higher prices that will be paid in the U.S. with a lack of interprovincial transmission, there are hard, low thresholds for internal Canadian electricity trade. For instance, if we look at the three largest electricity exporting provinces in 2022, about 74% of British Columbia's total exports were to the U.S., 63% of Quebec's exports were to the U.S., and 81% of Ontario's total exports were to the U.S., creating more potential avenues for interprovincial electricity trade by facilitating commercially viable shovel-ready projects that would, if permitting complete, would substantially reduce barriers to new construction. With more interprovincial electricity trade capacity, increased future trading of electricity in Canada could become a more likely reality, should there become an economic incentive. If Canada is to meet the moment and come through the challenges ahead, a more cooperative intergovernmental stance is required. This will see increased construction of generation and transmission, greater interprovincial trade of electricity, greater speed in approvals, and more coherent use of policy to clearly signal economic outcomes. With this approach, Canada can improve growth and productivity, helping to improve living standards, quality of life, and overall direction of the country. Without these necessary changes, missed emissions reduction commitments from Ottawa and mismanagement of our vaunted electricity sector will be just another marker on the road to decline.
That was a commentary by Andrew Evans. He is a master's student at Columbia University, where he is also a research assistant at the Center on Global Energy Policy. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca.
Hi, Hub Podcast listener. Fun fact to share with you. Well, not really. In 2024, thanks to new federal legislation, the majority of most journalist salaries in Canada will be funded by a combination of supports from Google Canada and the Government of Canada. Yes, you heard me right. Here at The Hub, we think this is bad for journalism and bad for news and information consumers like you. And this is why The Hub will not be taking these government supports. But producing high-quality news and analysis that is independent is expensive and time-consuming. And this is why we are asking you now to become a Hub subscriber for as little as 25 cents a day. Get all kinds of great benefits, including subscriber-only analysis of the economy and politics, podcast content, and so much more, all with the knowledge that your support makes our independent journalism possible. Join now at thehub.ca.
Our second essay is by Norman Seabrass, writing on why the Supreme Court should stick to the law and leave politics to the rest of us.
The official X account of the Supreme Court of Canada recently tweeted that achieving gender parity among judges at all levels in Canada is a step in the right direction towards having greater diversity on the bench. No doubt many people agree with this statement, but that does not make it appropriate. That is because it is a political position about the right direction to take the country, and a contentious political statement at that. In the United States, about 2 in 3 Americans, at 68%, including a majority in each ethnic group, said that last year's ruling by the Supreme Court of the United States ending the use of race and ethnicity in university admission decisions is mostly a good thing. In Canada, one poll has suggested that a significant majority of Canadians would support a constitutional amendment to prohibit affirmative action programs. Of course, the Supreme Court should not be making statements one way or the other based on what a majority of the population thinks. That is exactly the point. The Supreme Court must decide cases according to law, not according to politics. As the Supreme Court has explained, public confidence in our legal system is rooted in the fundamental belief that those who adjudicate in law must always do so without bias or prejudice and must be perceived to do so. Bias or prejudice means a leaning, inclination, bent or predisposition towards one side or another, or a particular result. It represents a predisposition to decide an issue or cause in a certain way which does not leave the judicial mind perfectly open to conviction. In order to ensure public confidence in the courts, even the appearance of bias must be avoided. That is why judges cannot speak publicly on any matter that may come before them. Issues relating to affirmative action are not only political, they are also legal. For example, the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal has held that it is not contrary to the province's Human Rights Act to discriminate against white people. If that case or one like it were to be appealed to the Supreme Court, could we be confident that the court does not have a predisposition to decide the issue a certain way? This is a particularly unfortunate time for the Supreme Court to be chiming in on this political issue. It is well known within the legal profession that the Trudeau government is aggressively pursuing an agenda of diversity hiring and appointments to the judiciary. The Supreme Court of Canada should not be seen as endorsing a divisive political agenda that relates so directly to the demographic composition and ideological orientation of the judiciary. It might be said that there can be no objection to the court endorsing an affirmative action program because Section 15, Article 2 of the Charter permits affirmative action. But just because a governmental policy is constitutionally permissible does not mean that it is normatively desirable. Applying affirmative action to judicial appointments is a controversial political decision. Even if it were clearly constitutional, it would not be appropriate for the Supreme Court to act as a cheerleader. Suppose the court had decided a case on the constitutionality of carbon taxing and decided in a unanimous decision that the tax was clearly constitutional. It would nonetheless be inappropriate for the court to tweet the next day the carbon tax is a great policy measure that we wholeheartedly endorse. Any such statement would cause us to question whether the court had come to its conclusion based on legal reasoning or on the basis of partisan politics. We aspire, or we used to aspire, to a court that is above the political fray. Further, it is one thing to say that the Charter protects affirmative action programs and another to say that a particular affirmative action program is constitutional. Suppose an affirmative action program provided that disadvantaged youth of South Asian, East Asian, Hispanic, or Pacific Islander background could apply for a full university scholarship, but youths of an African background were ineligible. Would that be constitutional? That would turn on the interpretation of Section 15, Article 2. The fact that the Charter permits affirmative action in broad terms does not mean that it permits a program such as just described. Any legal question turns on the details of the law and the specific facts at hand, and in the absence of legal analysis and evidence, it is inappropriate for the court to comment. The court followed up by tweeting that Canadians need to see themselves reflected in their judiciary because that builds trust in our democratic institutions. This raises similar problems. Again, this is a very common sentiment, but is it true? At least one study shows support for the intuition that same-race judges are more likely to impose harsher sentences, which might suggest that criminal defendants would prefer a judge of a different ethnicity. Of course, one study does not establish this is true, and even if it is true, it is debatable as to whether that should influence how judges should be appointed. But that is the point. that people prefer judges of their own ethnicity is debatable, not a self-evident truth. More generally, is it true that Canadians are so race-conscious that their trust in the judiciary is based on the ethnicity of the judges, rather than on the care and transparency of the process and reasons? That is an emotional and disputed question, and the truth lies in facts and evidence, not intuition. It is inappropriate for the Supreme Court to be making extrajudicial statements on controversial matters of fact and policy. The official X account of the Supreme Court of Canada is written by staff, not by the judges themselves, and this particular tweet was probably the work of a young staffer. But social media is the new town square. Canadians will reasonably look to official social media statements as a reflection of the views of the court itself. Presumably, the Chief Justice has authority over the account. Whether this tweet reflects the actual views of the court or merely appears to do so, public confidence in the Supreme Court as an institution has been undermined.
That was a commentary by Norman Seabrass. He is a professor of law at the University of New Brunswick. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.